Hey, what's up, guys? I'm Cedric the Entertainer, and I feel short and indifferent, sometimes angry about being Conan's friend.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
A little girl, is your daddy home? Here to go and leave you all alone. And then a weeper. I'm on turn up, baby. Is it good to you? Did he buy you
so
high school?
We're waiting on you.
Yeah, I'm working this out. I'm trying to get into
the
mode.
This is like rehearsal. Okay.
You think what I do is easy? You think I just open my mouth and babble like a baboon? No.
The fuck? Oh, my God. When you die, they should give your brain to research.
There we go. I think research should take my brain long before I die. It's not helping me out any. Look, this was all good stuff, and we didn't record it. We are recording.
We got to keep this in.
This is all in.
Yeah.
Listen, we were getting ready to record an episode of Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, but I started babbling, and I was doing some kind of song. Hey, little girl, is your dad home? Need to go. Was Dad doing that?
You were, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if we can clear that. Do we have to clear it, or is that not matter on
your,
the podcast?
Your version of it is so far removed from
hey,
the original.
Hey, little girl, is your dad home? Need to go. We're going to leave you all alone. Yeah, mine is sort of like a hoedown.
Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen.
It's weird.
Under 8 seconds, we're fine. Let's keep going.
My wedding night.
Oh, boo!
Yay! Funniest joke in the world was just told by Conan O'Brien. And now it's a song. Now it's a song. And now it's a rap. Okay, let's stop.
That beatboxing
is the best,
right? Oh, was that what that was?
That was his
No, no, that was me having
I thought there was a loose clothes dryer somewhere.
That was anaphylactic shock. Many times I've had an adverse reaction to like a peanut butter that I was supposed to eat. And I start going, and people gather around me and start rapping.
Is that what that, well, what would it sound like if you tried to beatbox? Oh, so the exact same thing. Okay.
Yeah, I like to do little.
It sounds and looks like you're on an iron lung when you do that.
But a high-end iron lung.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
When I had an iron lung as a child, it was the Cadillac of iron lungs.
Oh,
it was
nice.
A really good one. Does anyone even know what an iron lung is anymore that we're talking to? We have such a young fan base.
It's just a respirator, right?
Yeah.
It was a giant box they put you in that helped you breathe back long before there was a real respirator. But it looked like you were encased in a giant, I don't know, it looked like an old boiler.
There's one in The Big Lebowski.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, then people do know what it is.
Do people know what The Big Lebowski is anymore?
I don't know. We've got to make sure our references are cool.
Of course they do.
Of course they do.
Cool and up to date. That's what we have to make sure.
No, people know The Big Lebowski. That's what I learned when I learned what a white Russian was.
Oh. Yeah. It's made with Kahlua.
And then you met your husband.
Yeah.
Huh?
A white Russian? What?
Oh,
my God. He is Russian. And he is white.
He's a Soviet. He's not a Russian.
What's the difference?
Yeah, really.
What do you mean, what's the difference? That the Soviet Union was a lot of different countries. And so people from, like, you know, Moldova aren't Russian. They're Soviets.
I understand that. Does he consider himself? By the way, this intro is all over the map. We're beatboxing. We're talking about the breakup of the former Soviet Union.
Iron lungs.
Mm-hmm. This is a mess of an intro, and I love it.
Yeah, it's good.
This is the Jackson Pollock of podcast intros. It's just a bunch of splatter on a canvas.
Did you even start the podcast? Did you say what the podcast was called?
Oh, if people are listening to this and don't know what it is, fuck them.
Well, they've also
downloaded
it.
I mean, I'm serious.
And you did.
They downloaded it, and my face is on it, and if someone's going, what is this? Conan hasn't properly prepared me for what I'm about to hear.
Now we're talking. Here he goes. This is what I've been trying to get you to be.
First of all, what is a Conan? Is he that scallywag that replaced Letterman in 93? Because I won't have it. Second of all, what's a podcast? Where's Walter Cronkite? I'm upset. Where's my phonograph needle? Well, this is Conan O'Brien. Mom, the Conan O'Brien needs a fan. Blah, blah, blah. Jesus
Christ. This is great.
Christ.
I love this. This is the way it should be.
This is the way all the intros should be.
This is
Pulitzer stuff.
I just want to know how that guy even found the podcast. I mean, I don't get it. Oh, okay.
No. It's like one of his grandchildren got into his Stutz Bearcat and they just had Bluetooth put in it. And he was like, he got it to the front and turned the crank and fired it up. And he got in and he heard me babbling about iron lungs. Oh, I remember having one of those as a child.
They have a Stutz Bearcat with Bluetooth.
Yeah. Oh, I'm saying his grandson put it in. His grandson okay. installed it.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's like, what is this tooth of blue? Whose voice am I hearing? What an irritable woman she is. Papa, Papa, Grandpapa, that's Conan. This is a podcast we're listening to. Rugga chugga chugga chugga, rugga chugga chugga chugga, rugga chugga, honk, honk. Well, I'll take you for a ride because it's Sunday and that is our tradition. But listening to this man is just terrible, if he is indeed a man. Hugga chugga, hugga chugga. Now remember, you'll get a lot of inherited wealth. And then you'll go to the Ivy League school, I declare. Yes, grandfather!
Oh, here he is.
Oh, hard right turn. Kid falls out. Ah!
Oh, no!
Don't worry, there are 7 more of those back at the estate. Good thing we're real breeders. Anyway, if you can decipher this intro, good luck to you, because I sure can't. What a bag of mush that was.
And yet indicative of the quality of this podcast overall.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We've caught lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
A man freestyling with his 2 chums who add up to 8%. I'm telling you, with the 3 of us... Well, that's a lot
that's
when you think
generous.
About it.
That yeah. is generous.
No, I know. Yeah. But Gorley's a solid 6.
Oh, I'm only 2% of it.
I think in the state of this intro, this is a compliment, meaning we're not contributing to this absolute horseshit. You know what I mean?
When the episodes are good, you guys are contributing 70%.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, we should get going.
Let's
and
do
again,
it.
Very interested for fans to diagram what just happened in this intro.
Flowcharts. Venn diagrams.
Oh, yeah. And also things where you have photographs and there's yarn connecting them.
Oh, yeah.
When you're looking
that
for
stuff.
A serial killer. Yeah. Do that with this intro because, good Lord, I don't know what happened. Hey, my guest today. Look at me. I'm professional all of a sudden. This is a hilarious actor and comedian. Now he has a new novel, Flipping Boxcars, available September 12th. I adore this man. I'm excited he's here. Cedric the Entertainer. All right. Well, I'm so glad you're here because we have a lot to talk about. First of all, you're a genius because you named yourself Cedric the Entertainer.
Man.
That is the smartest move anyone's made in the history of show business because no one can question it. It's like, no, it's on my tax return. I am the entertainer.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go. You know what? And it actually kind of happened, though. It was weird. It was weird because another dude called me that first. And it was only because I didn't have a lot of jokes. I used to sing a lot and you know, do poetry on stage, anything I could do to fill up the time. And so I just told dude, don't call me a comedian, call me an entertainer. And that's how it happened. So, and I just kept the name from there. But then like when I first got to Hollywood, they definitely wanted me to change that. That was like, you know, all the agents is like, no, go by your government name, Cedric Schaefer. No, it's not. It's not Schaefer, guys.
You know, I tagged you for a Schaefer. The minute you walked in, I tagged you for a Schaefer. I'm like,
it was like
this guy's Jewish. I know
it's
it.
It's already been a hard time finding my dad as it is, but that would be...
No, it's
that
just...
would have been even more of a challenge.
Also,
I'm like,
I love
you sure, Mom.
I love like Schaefer? You go to these people for creative advice, and their advice is use your government name.
Yeah, exactly.
What? Yeah, what are you exactly. talking about?
I think so. I wonder what Bono would do. You know,
Patty like, O'Malley.
Yeah,
you know,
come
who
on,
wants
that's
to hear,
great.
No one wants to hear
no
that
one
guy.
Hear a rock dude say, "Hey, Patty,
give us another one.
Yeah, give us another one. Think about the Joshua Tree." But really, like when you're out there and bored and living there in a tent, that version.
You are hilariously funny. First time I saw you, and you really came to my notice was, and I want to go back before that, but Kings of Comedy is when I felt like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
And I didn't know, and I thought that was such a great film because it featured you all so brilliantly. It showed that you are. You still are the kings of comedy. It's amazing. It's a beautiful thing.
Man, no, that was such a unique
time. What year
time.
Was that? Was that late 90s or early 2000s?
Early 2000s.
Okay.
We started the tour in the late 90s. It was so 98 was the first dates, but we didn't shoot the movie until like 01, right at the end of 2000 to 01, right in there. And so, you know, fun time, man. You know, comedy was growing. You know, the idea that shows like Def Comedy Jam had started to really put like black comedians yep. in the forefront of like just having an audience that was our very own. So, you know, when we by putting us all together, we were able to do arenas. And it was a few people that had done, you know, of course, Dice and Eddie Murphy. I think Martin had done arena tours, but nobody kind of did it like this, you know, like Coachella. Like, we, yes. you know, you got a lot of your favorites there at one night. And so that was fun. That was rock star stuff, man. We had a blast on that tour.
I also think it blew up awareness that needed to happen. It blew up awareness in a really beautiful way that you guys are a force. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You weren't trying to get other people into the tent. You were saying, we don't need that.
Yeah.
This is what we do. We're hilarious. And look at this whole world that follows us. And you should be here too. I remember thinking, Jesus Christ, these guys are a phenomenon.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're right. And I think that was really what became a catalyst to opening up. You know, of course, we had like, you know, the networks with like WB and UPN starting to, you know, like create shows for predominantly African-American families. But it definitely opened up this idea like comedy is not like the evening at the improv way, which yep. was the only way you can get on television, right?
Right.
If back then you do evening at the improv and try to get picked to be on Carson or
yes.
Leno or something like that. And then, you know, you came along at a time when it was far, you know,
things
you were one
up.
Of us. That's what makes you cool.
Then,
that's what everybody goes. Everybody, you know, I'm just saying in the hood, everybody goes.
Trust
oh.
me.
Everybody goes, oh, Conan O'Brien,
oh,
he's
yeah.
one of us.
He's one of us? Oh, I swear to God, I get that all the time. Don't laugh, Sona. I get that all the time. When I go to the hood, people are like, oh, good, you're
yeah,
back in the hood.
Yeah, you're back. And everybody's like, yo, yeah. I mean, I go in the barbershop. You see Conan lately? I'm like, yeah, man, that's my N-word.
Yeah. Come on, Sona, how many times have you been looking for me and I've been at the barbershop?
Oh, yeah, oh, so many times.
Just shooting the shit.
Yeah, just hanging out.
Getting a nice fade. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, that's you.
I need a fade so badly.
You should go like to Philadelphia where they do the linings, where they yes. line up you. You haven't had facial hair in a long time, though.
No, I shaved it off a long time. Yeah, I did. I had a beard for a while and then I shaved it. Will Ferrell actually said, shave it or I'm coming on the show and I'll shave it. And I didn't shave it. So he came on the show, brought a barber chair and shaved
wow.
me. And it was hilarious.
That's
and
great.
Then I thought, once Will Ferrell shaves you, you can't go back.
No, that's it.
That's it.
No,
so that's I was it. Done after that. But I have to say, the other thing that has always impressed me is you have such amazing style. You really have I mean, even the hat you're wearing right now
oh,
is fantastic.
Yeah. These are fun. This is a good friend of mine, this guy, James Keith. The company is named Keith James, but he, you know, he came up with this red bottom hat like a few years ago, and it was me and Floyd Mayweather. We kind of jumped on early, and then everybody, you know, it's a very popular hat, the red bottom hat. So this is cool. You can go and grab
That's
it.
That's a very cool looking hat.
Yeah.
I don't think I could pull it off. I think you have to be able to pull it off. And when I put
yeah.
a hat on, I look like a child that stole his father's hat. That's what it looks like. Do you know what I mean? It just does. And I've got a massive head, so even a big hat looks like a yarmulke on me.
So, yeah.
Which you can relate
yeah,
to, Mr.
Yeah.
Schaefer.
Sure. Yes, of course.
But, you know, it's amazing because I'm curious. That was something you were interested in even as a young man, as a kid, you were very interested in style.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I grew up in a small town in Missouri, Caruthersville, Missouri. But my mother, who was probably, you know, I guess in her generation, was one of the first people to kind of go away to college and then
mm-hmm.
come back.
Yep.
And so she, you know, she knew how to do the order from the catalogs and you know, so people would normally shop at the little local store in town. But my mother would be like, you know, ordering from magazines. And so very early on, I could remember having like nice outfits when I go to school,
right.
Third, fourth grade, like people would know me for my clothes. And so it's not like today's generation where you got to have like the top thing, you know, like everybody, like you got to have Jordans or these shoes. It's just like you just wanted to have something different than the other kids.
Yeah.
And so I think that became, a part of like my identity for sure. And then coming from St. Louis, that was another thing too. Like Midwest was very, I remember like my family would dress up on Saturday mornings to do nothing. Like you would go by and you're like, where are you going? No, nowhere. Just full fledged, beautiful outfits on. And that was kind of the way, like people love to show off their clothes. So I think I brought that to the stage, and it was good because I think very like right after me, the kind of jeans and T-shirt thing became very popular. And I kind of like that. I treat going on the stage more like a yes. professional.
Yes.
Yeah.
I always like, even to this day, if I'm on stage, I like to put on a tie. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm wearing it with a jean jacket, but I'm wearing a tie because sure. I like to create the difference between... It's like if you get up at the altar or something in church,
yeah.
you want to have a little bit of that feeling of separation that I'm dressing up to go do this thing that's very important to me.
Yeah.
And you have to show it in very small ways. But, you know, I didn't realize how much clothes could influence a person. I had no clothes. I was nude for years. But it wasn't until I was like in my late 20s.
Ladies and gentlemen, Conan O'Brien.
Then shrieks. Yeah, yeah. Shrieks.
Wearing anything.
I can see his veins.
Here, take my yarmulke.
Cover that thing up.
Cover your other head.
So but it's true that I didn't have a sense. And I remembered getting some important gig and going and needing a suit and going out and buying like a nice suit. And I put it on, but I was in my late 20s before I owned like a really nice suit. And I remembered thinking, this makes me feel better about myself.
Oh, definitely.
It was as much for me as for anybody else. And I think when you get up on stage and you want to feel like you look good. It helps you'll take anything that will help a little bit.
No, definitely. That's so important. I don't think people like take that into account anymore. Like, cause it's just really a world where you can just show up with whatever you got on and everybody's just like, it's all about the artist, which is fine, you know? But I say that same thing. I remember when those like suit warehouse places kind of came on. You mm-hmm. could get like three suits for $100 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I used to like sell fax machines. Like I used to sell the Rico fax machine. And I remember having one of those suits and I lucked up and got one like a Zanuti or some brand that felt like it was like, ooh, this is really Italian.
Right.
But I remember that particular suit made me feel extremely aristocratic. Like I was like, oh, the laugh changed. I did that laugh actually.
Yeah, yeah. When
I, oh, guys, come on. Yeah, anybody can get a message from you. Like, just put this in there. This is going to be the thing for the next 7 decades.
The fax is never going away.
Never going out. You're going to need this. Trust me. You can own this forever, fam.
You were a claims adjuster for State Farm's insurance for a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yep. That was,
Were you good? Were you a good claims adjuster?
No. Let's just get that out there. And you know,
in case anyone's trying to hire you,
yeah.
In
case somebody's still in a rental car,
yeah,
you know, which is probably the kind of stuff I would do. I was like one of those claims adjusters. Like, you give me any hard luck story, I'm like, okay, sure, that makes sense. And to the point that one year,
a mummy stole your house.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah, I get it. Mummies. It's been a rash. Trust me, I see it all the time. I haven't seen it. I got files just stacked up over here. You're good. But I definitely, people would start to come to me around prom and graduation time and have these made up accidents so that I can get them rental cars for their kids to drive. So, you know, and I knew that's what was going on. So uh-huh. they like, oh, you know, I got, somebody ran into me at the grocery store. I'm like, okay, got it. We'll say that your car needs a 2-day thing and go ahead, rent the Cadillac for the daughter. I know what you're doing. I'm going to give you an upgrade.
Thank you. it's prom.
Yeah, yeah. State Farm was like, no.
Not cool.
But I was able to, I was able to do that for a while. That was a fun kind of professional gig where you did learn, like all the differences between people's personalities, because car people are exactly kind of who you think they are. Like Corvette people are the best. If you can't tell a Corvette person anything, they drive a Corvette. You're like, we didn't have Ferraris in St. Louis, so that was rare. If I met a Ferrari person, I would be in awe. Yeah.
To this day, I've never driven any of those fancy cars.
Really?
I've never driven a Ferrari or a Lamborghini or a Bugatti or any of those. I don't even know what it's like to drive one. I don't know that I've been in one.
Yeah, I had a Ferrari for like maybe a couple of months. It kept breaking. It was weird. I don't know. I felt like I had a lemon or something, so I didn't really keep that one. And then I got in a Lamborghini one time, and it's so low. It just really wasn't made for, brothers of my girth. So it was quite embarrassing.
You know what they should do?
It's like you pull up in a $300,000 car and then got to do some kind of drop and roll. All righty.
The valet is like, yes, yes.
Thank you.
Hey, 9.8. 9.8.
Like, once I put the gas in, I'm waiting until everybody else leaves before I get in,
They should have tailors for cars. They should have people that what I mean? Like, you want a Ferrari? I make you a Ferrari. and they measure you, and then they get you that slightly wider, rounder Ferrari.
I love Giuseppe.
I love Giuseppe.
That's who's making the Ferrari.
Oh, you like a Ferrari?
You like a Ferrari.
Oh, I make you a Ferrari.
Giuseppe, thank you. Thank you, Giuseppe.
For you, Mr. Entertainer, anything.
But of course.
A lot of us listen to comedians and watch comedians when we're younger, and we sort of start to zone in on different people. Who was it for you when you're a young man or a late teen or whatever? Who are you watching? Who are you listening to?
Well, who's the couple of figures that really popped for you? Probably the most, prevalent foremost one is the late Robin Harris. Mm-hmm. That's who I kind of really decided, that I can do comedy. I emulated him. He was a regular dude that was funny. So he came off like an uncle or a cousin.
Right.
And it became a delivery. Now, of course, I loved Eddie Murphy. And then Richard Pryor would be one of my first introductions, because, my uncles would be playing the albums and you would listen and hear it. And so, of course, those guys were one. Eddie Murphy was just extremely the most talented person ever. He could sing, he would do sketches, he could do stand up. He was just like, oh man, this the dude. But he was definitely a superstar from the very beginning. So, again, coming from St. Louis, you just don't see yourself as that dude. Like, for whatever reason, he's a star. He's from New York. That's another thing to climb to. But Robin Harris was from Chicago, and he would come on stage just like as a regular dude, like your uncle, your cousin. I was like, oh, if you could do it like that, then. So he became the person I kind of based like why I can do comedy. Mm-hmm. and then really took the steps to move forward because I saw him do it, and he became my favorite.
And you were, I think, if I know the story correctly, you go to a comedy club and the guy, and it was in maybe Texas, and the guy working the comedy club or booking it is Steve Harvey.
Yes.
And that's how you guys met?
Yes.
So you went there and you basically said, can I get up on stage? And they said, you have to go talk to Steve Harvey.
Yeah, it was, actually, I was in Dallas to do a different club. And when I got there, I was the opening act, and it was a new ownership. And he was like, well, I don't use, non-local opening acts. Sorry. And I was like, what? Like, bro, I drove 10 hours. I was supposed to make $350 for 19 or 17 shows. I don't know how, they would just abuse you back then. come do 11, do 14 shows and we'll give you $300. So, all right, thank you. You know, so,
and half a milkshake.
Yeah.
Don't ask where the other half went.
Do not. Has this been opened? Hey.
None of your fucking business.
Do you want it or not? You're like, sorry, I'm thirsty. But Steve was starting his own little comedy night at a bar club kind of situation. And he had had a couple of weeks where he was killing it. I knew of him. He was like the big name of a comedian that was out. And so I went there and, you know, it was one comedian that introduced us, you know, just via like, hey, you need to hear about this guy. And he told me about Steve. So I was like, yo, I know this guy. And he was like, oh, yeah, come on in. And it just so happens that the headliner that week was not doing well. And so he was like, you think you can handle this crowd? And he said, I'm going to put you up on stage to do 5 minutes. And so I went up and I killed it. And he just told me, if I come back every night, if this guy doesn't do well, I'm going to put you on stage. And so I never really hoped for somebody to do bad. But, man, you talking about juju. I like come like every night and just look at that guy like. Oh, God, of failed jokes and punchlines.
Isn't that a terrible feeling?
Because
we've all had it. I like to think I'm a good person, but we've all been in those situations where we're like, please fail.
Exactly. It was so bad. But it was one of those situations where Steve and I became very close from that, because I ended up going and doing well. He gave me a couple of $100 to get home. And then they brought me back to headline like a few months later. And then our relationship started from there. So we just ended up being friends.
And you guys have been tight ever since.
Ever since. That was probably late 90s.
Is it true you guys vacation together? You'll go. What's that like?
Yeah.
What's it like when you two just hang out on a beach?
Well, you know, Steve is definitely became a super fashion person now. So now it's like too much anxiety of me trying to figure out what my outfits are going to be. It used to be just like cool man buddies, but like now he's like become some fashion icon. And so like I can't even be near him without like having my drip right. Like I'm like, so it's like, you know, the whole time before the vacation, it's like, okay, does these shorts go with that? What shoes should I? I'm not going to go.
Also, you're looking out the window with binoculars. What's he wearing? I don't want to show up at dinner. I don't want to clash. I don't want to match.
Is that a cape? Is that a flowy cape? What is going on? Like, this dude is like killing the game, man. But we usually golf, laugh a lot, you know.
That's good.
You know, just have a good time. You know, he can gamble too, and I'm not much of a gambler, but usually whenever I'm gambling with Steve, I make money. So that's the only time that I like to kind of go, because he'll be like, you know, he plays cards and he'll show me like, do this. And I'm like, all right, well, cool. I just won. But I would never do it on my own. Like I'm not a gambler. Like
I'm not
that.
Either. But if I'm around someone, I just tell them, please tell me what to do.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it goes badly, I have someone to hate, which makes it work out.
Yeah, the last trip, we were in the Bahamas together. And I actually, when I was leaving, I had like maybe like $3,000 worth of chips in my pocket and totally forgot. So it was like, what did I do with this? So I look like a big timer because I was just like giving people chips on the way out. You know, like, you go, man. Thanks, bro. Except for the bags, my man, take that.
Here you go, customs agent.
Yeah, don't look in that bag. All right, but here you go. It's not a bribe, my friend. It's just a chip, but take it over there.
Has he, I would think, the one thing I think of when I see Steve now, it's always Family Feud. I see him doing Family Feud. And the one thing I worry about is that doing a gig like that over and over and over again would like start to get to your mind. Do you know what I mean? I worry sometimes that like it would.
That you talk to people.
I don't know. That just over and over and over again, doing the Family Feud would change
top
him.
Five appetizers before you order. Let's go. Let's get it on. Come on, Sana. Come on up there. Give it to me.
Buffalo wings.
Buffalo wings. Number two. French fries. Let's give it to me. Caesar salad.
Then you give him one that clearly disappoints him.
Yeah.
Stewed tomatoes.
Stewed. Oh, hell no. I know that ain't up there.
You know he's doing that when he... You know, and you know if you wake him up at 3 in the morning, that's what
that's
he's
how
like.
He wakes up.
Yeah. Yeah. And the survey says...
You can't ask him a question without it being phrased like... Yeah, that's probably so true. And they do a lot of them at once, too. That's the other thing. Like, when they shoot those shows,
that's
they,
how
like,
they
block
do it.
Them. Like, so you're right. I think in that period of time, it just got to be in your head because you're doing like 100. Sometimes they do like 106 shows in a matter of like 3 months. So just day, every day, like popping them off. Like, boom, boom,
right, and then
boom.
Change suit and act like, okay, now it's Christmas time, even though you're shooting it in July. Right. You know, you just keep going and going and going.
Exactly.
We should do the podcast that way. We should do like 30 a day.
Never stop.
Cedric, you got to go. We got someone else coming in 8 seconds. They're just stacked up like planes on the airport.
Yeah, just the amount of guests that you have. Like, just
I don't even know what I'm doing. I start to forget who's who.
This is the pilot that flew me home.
Asking people the wrong questions about
the wrong
projects.
Yeah.
I got my barista coming up next. And it's just the guy from today, not... my regular baristas. It was a random stop, and I told him to come on the show.
Just get in there.
Get in there.
Well,
talk
so I ordered
you know, coffee?
Know.
Go, go.
I ordered a latte. What's in a latte anyway?
What's in a latte? Why latte? Why is the name? Seems weird. It seems lazy. With coffee, it's opposite. When you look at it, latte, you know. Thought it was supposed to get me up.
Okay, get the fuck out of here. I'm done with
thanks
you.
Thanks a lot for nothing.
Who's next?
It's a revolving
door. Director Werner Herzog. Get in here, Werner. This is madness. This is insanity. Shut up, Werner. I got to ask you about a friend of yours, Tracy Morgan, because he's a friend of mine as well. And I know you've worked with him on The Last OG, and it's just, he's this guy who if Tracy wasn't famous, I couldn't explain him to anybody. Is that right?
True. I just talked to Tracy the other day, so I called him just on some random, hey, bro, checking in, you know, and he just goes like you've been having a conversation. Mm-hmm. Said, it don't make no sense, you know? It's just the way that it is, you know? Yeah. You know, you got it. I agree. 100%.
That's a lot of money for fish.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, he's really into the fish.
Oh, he's into the fish.
The fish are crazy.
You know, I'm telling you, this is a true story. Well, during COVID, when we were doing the interviews, and people would be on Zoom, and I'm talking to him, and he's talking and being crazy. And that's crazy enough. Just trying to talk to the man is insane. Talk to Tracy Morgan, have a conversation with him is insane. And then a barracuda swam behind him. Yeah. And I was like, what the? And he was like, that's my fish tank. And it's not a fish tank. It's a fish tank the size of this studio that's in his house.
Yes.
And it's got sharks and barracudas. It's like he's a James Bond villain who's, you know what I mean?
You look up and it's like groups of kids doing field trips through there. It's a very odd thing. Like, it's such a big fish tank in someone's house. You're like, is that Khan Academy kids? Who are these kids? Why do they have uniforms on? Like, and the fish have names. And they're usually rarer than just what you say.
Yeah.
It's not just a barracuda. It's some crazy, unique barracuda that he's found, you know, off the shores of Seashell or somewhere. It's like, you're like, what?
He's
like, yo, that's Myron. That's my man's right there.
Myron.
Yeah, it's Myron. He's a barracuda. He's a barracuda, but he get everybody pregnant. He get all the other fish pregnant.
Who was it? He was on the podcast. We did a podcast in New York City, and he came on, and I hugged him when he came out, and he smelled... I got a thought. He had this powerful cologne on. I'm like, what is that? And he said, it's Jupe. And you know the way he holds it for a long time, and he looks at the whole crowd, and he's just was telling us, Jupe, it's Jupe.
And he made half the segment about Joop. And Joop was delighted.
Yeah.
Because no one's talked about Joop in a long
years,
time.
Exactly.
Yeah. But he gets into something and he can make.
Yeah, you can barely get that in the middle of the mall nowadays. I don't even know.
Well, they sent us a crate.
He sent you a bottle.
He sent me a bottle. It's a classic, though. It's one of those ones like Corus and Joop and Lagerfeld. Those were the ones when we grew up on. Smelling great and groovy.
Yeah.
Obsession.
I put a little on and didn't say anything, and I went home to my wife.
Yes.
And
come on, man.
No, it didn't go well.
Yeah, of course not.
She made me check into a hotel.
Yeah. You're not a cologne guy.
I'm not a cologne guy. Yeah. I have my own odor that's tough enough. I smell like onions and fear.
It's a nice
combination.
The combination.
Oh, the combination.
That's what people don't know. Like it's like mixing colors in the crayon box. It's great.
It's great.
Onions and fear come out.
You know, I heard you say once, which I really liked, you were talking about how with the exception of that guy who you needed to knock out in order to get your start in show business, that is a rare exception for you because you don't root against other comedians. You're happy for them to do well because your theory has always been, you know, it's like that concept that a rising tide lifts all the boats.
Yeah.
You're rooting for other people to do well. You think it's going to expand the space.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, I mean, because, you know, creativity is definitely that. Like, if you're around creative people, I mean, just like this vibe, you know, like the energy lifts up. You start saying things or doing things that you would never have thought of before. So, you know, it's great to be around, like, people that are, that they can be young or older, but they bring in a good vibe and good energy, then, you know, that's usually going to inspire you to go higher, you know? So that's why I like that. That's why I kind of love that attitude of like when people are killing it or they bring something new to the game or something like that, you're like, yo, let's go. I like that. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great attitude. I'm going to pretend to have the same attitude.
I like it.
No, I really do. I like to root for people and it's just like in the time that I've known Kevin Hart, he went from being, you know, this guy that would come on our show to, I think he's basically has the gross national product of like a fairly well-to-do country now.
Yeah,
you know, like he's everywhere. He's in every commercial. He's in every single commercial, and they just switch out what he's holding. He doesn't even know. they take out one credit card and they put a different one in. But he has such a positive energy, and I always get energized when I'm around him.
Yeah,
because it's coming from a good place. This is what he loves.
That's what's so great. I think that a lot of people too, like Kevin literally is one of those people, like you go, you know, he's the same person as when you kind of knew him back when.
Yep.
You know, even though he's like extremely successful and really rich, he really is very approachable and regular dude.
And he'll go like, right into, what did you say? That's bullshit. Like he's right there and connected.
Yeah.
He starts giving me shit about like what I'm wearing immediately in this very friendly, in touch way. Whereas, as we all know, people that have hit it and then something happens. It's like they go behind a bubble forms around them.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems to be less of that. I guess probably nowadays with social media, the opportunity where people kind of know you a little bit more. But I think you're right. I think that it used to be being a star meant you had to be a little more reclusive. You had to give off this persona of I'm kind of other than, you know, I'm a little bit more than the average person. But now I think, you know, if you do that to somebody, you know, like at a damn Starbucks, then, you know, you big time them, then, you know, they can light you up all day on, you know, and next, you know, it just starts a wave. You're like, no, I just didn't see you, you know. I had my sunglasses on or whatever, but, you know, I think you gotta protect yourself as a human being. Like, you know, I was always one when my kids were little and I was a stickler for, you know, like making sure that people understood I was with my children. Like, let's try to get at some merit, guys. Like, it's not that I don't want to take pictures with you or, you know, but, you know, I'm with my little kids, right? You know, and I'm not going to.
I find
that
mostly people respect that.
Yeah.
For the most part. And if they don't, that's telling you something about them.
It's about them, right? Yeah. Exactly. You're the target. Yeah, so that's the hard thing, you know, until I turn the target on you.
Jesus, what happened to you? Huh? You totally switched. Yeah. You all right?
What happened?
Yeah. You off your meds?
Yeah.
You know, I was curious about something because you've done, clearly, you love getting out in front of a crowd and doing stand-up, but you've also had this success with The Neighborhood, which is now going into its sixth, I think it's sixth season now, which is, you think about it, for a television show, sitcom, to go six seasons and be chugging along and doing well, that's an achievement. How do you feel about that process, the process of, okay, we're going to work on it for a week and then we're going to shoot it, which is very different, very different from I'm going to get up on stage, this is all me 100%. I've sometimes found I just love to be me.
Yeah.
And then if I'm in a situation where they say, okay, we're going to change it so that you have to behave yourself, enter and hit your mark, I realize, oh, I'm a chimp. I'm a chimp on some kind of cocaine. I'm not supposed to do that.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, it's something that, you know, it was definitely a part of my kind of like trajectory. Like, so, you know, like coming up when I did it, that was the goal, as was to get a sitcom. So I got, you know, I was able to be on a Steve Harvey show pretty young in my career, and then, you know, was able to do a lot of television afterwards. So I actually loved that process, you know, and getting to like a show like The Neighborhood, like being on a major network. And having a great cast, like that's the other thing. Like everybody's like super pros. They came from other shows, to Sheena and Max and Beth, and even the two young sons, Shion and Marcel. These are all like.
And Max is, I have to say, Max is an off the charts performer.
Yeah.
I mean, no. I used to see him on New Girl, mm-hmm. and he's just brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, and he's a kind person and funny and easygoing, and just keeps life simple. That's what's really so wonderful. So we actually operate in that space. So, you know, to be able to take a script and then, you know, shape it and tell the story of these two neighbors getting to know each other and becoming friends and what happens, it's been a blessing, man. So I really appreciate that, you know, the show works, you know, that people tune in each week and that we get to do it and that the network is behind it. Like, they pushing for it. So, you know, I'm ready to get back to work as soon as the strike over.
It's about something. You know, it's about something that we need to keep talking about. And I don't mean to find comedy in it, I think, is much more powerful than lecturing people or trying to have a, you know, it's talking about, you know, people of different races living in the same neighborhood and how is it all being worked out and what are the issues? And without being preachy, just being funny.
Yeah, that's the truth, man, because I think that's when the show first, you know, when it first came to me, that was kind of like the idea. And, you know, we definitely went through a phase where this idea of race separation and sexuality, you know, who you know, people felt like they had to draw these hard lines in the sand if you were this or you were that. And it was like, no, people are humans. And like, what if that person was your neighbor? You would have a totally different feeling about some, which we do usually, you know, when it comes to sexuality, or if somebody, your friend, and you work with them every day, or you live next to them, or they married into your family somehow, you don't look at them as some big group of people. You look at that person. You already know.
If you're sharing space with them, if you're breaking bread with them, if you're asking them, can I use your garden hose? Because mine's split. It's going to. Yeah. Then suddenly everything is quite different.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, a lot of times we kind of like get put in these like these barrels of groups, and people feel like they have to define themselves by the group, you know. And I think that's the idea of the show, was to show like the humanity and the people. And then, you know, of course, we think we have group think, but then we all are these individuals. And in inside that is where the relationships are. Mm-hmm. And so let's build from there, you know. So. I think that's really been the fun part of the show. Some of the things that we try to attack, you know, we're both married on the show. We both have kids. We're homeowners. You know, we're trying to figure it out. His wife is more the breadwinner. So he's got that kind of, you know, thing that we have to kind of figure out, like, what's that story we're telling there? You know, and you know how life has changed, where, you know, it used to be one way and now, you know, your wife can be the breadwinner in the family. Does that make you less of a man? Mm-hmm. Like these kind of things. And so we have we have those kind of things that we've been able to have fun with, like you say, and not be preachy about it. Just tell a good, funny story and then be like, all right, that was worthy.
So let's talk about, because this is, we've been talking a little bit about how you make these jumps because you clearly like to try things. You like to, you know, expand your, you know, your abilities and say like, okay, what can I try now? You write a book, fiction.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's cool about it is it's not at all what I expected, because I don't even know what I expected. But first of all, I think, okay, it's going to be your life story. No, it's not. It's a book of fiction. And then I think, okay, it'll be about a comedian who, nope, nothing like that.
Nah.
It's incredible. Flipping Boxcars, and it takes place in 1948.
Yeah.
And it really feels like, you know, this world, you really know these people. And the language, I mean, the terminology you're using, because I love 1940s, 1930s,
yeah.
1920s slang. I just love it. And I love to use it. I love people not to know what I'm talking about. but in this one, people are really using what sounds like very legitimate, real language. Tell us a little bit about the story.
Yeah, so this is the story about, loosely based on my grandfather, mm-hmm. who I never met. But, you know, I would hear these stories from my mother and my uncles and relatives. And my grandfather passed before I was even born. Yet, you know, as I started to, like, kind of come on my own rise, I would actually get these, I'll call them machinations, but be like daydreams of him, like, very vividly, you know, doing things. Like, I could see the suit he had on and what he would say in a certain situation. And so, you know, I would just jot them down sometimes. And so that really became the basis of this book, because some of these stories are based off real things. And then what I decided to do was create a fictional tale around the 4th of July in 1948 of him on this caper to try to make it. You know,
and it takes place in
Caruthersville, Missouri,
in your hometown,
real town where right. I grew up.
This is after World War II.
Yeah.
And it's and the central character
is Babe Boyce. That was my grandfather's real name. That's what they called me. His name was Floyd Boyce, but everybody called him Babe. And he was known as Babe Boyce, and he was like a famous gambler. And this was like dice, but, you know, it would be likened to the way we know poker players today, like famous poker players.
Right.
But back then, if you threw dice, you were known. And he was one of those guys. He was a businessman. He was a bit of a gangster. He was a civic man for the black side of town. You would go to him and he would know how to get people's gas turned on and, you know, get a fire truck over to the city side of the town. Like, he was just a mover and a shaker like that. And these were real stories that I would hear about. And then I just kind of told it as this fictional tale. So that's,
but it's funny, 'cause it revolves around this 4th of July celebration. And you talk about all these things that, really, that you've seen. There was like a greased pole that people were trying to climb.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking like, this didn't happen in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Yeah, they
would. I don't think this is true. It didn't happen in my neighborhood.
Yeah, those were the kind of, you know, those are the kind of carnival games, you know. But the greased pole, like, you would slide up a greased pole and you would win. And it was like one guy that was the hero, like, in his family is kind of legendary down there, the Agnews. And so, you know, this guy was always could win. Like, he could climb up this pole faster than anybody, but it'd be a greased pole, a real contest.
That was his claim to fame.
Hey, come on. Somebody had to be the guy. You know, he had a big banner out front of his home of.
Yeah, exactly.
Agnew, grease pole champion. You know, you ride.
Yeah, when he would walk into the bar, the piano player would stop.
Oh,
dun, dun, everything would freeze.
Yeah, like, watch it.
It's Greasy Pole Johnson. So I love this. There's a glossary of terms in the book, and my favorite one is the term for a blowhard or a braggart, a guy who talks a lot, is a gum beater.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I'm a gum beater. I'm a guy who, I don't have any other skill. I really don't think I have any skill other than
none.
I'm a gum beater.
Yeah.
I come in here and I just flap these gums and I keep going until I hit something, and then people go, here's your cookie, and they kick me out of here.
Yeah, man. And you can bring it back. And I think once people know you as a gum beater, Conan, you can embrace it. You know, you can be the head of the association, you know.
All right, everybody, quiet down.
Everybody's beating their gums.
Everybody's beating their gums. You
know, hey,
come on. I know you're all very good at this, but come on.
We've had 9 meetings of gum beaters, and we haven't agreed on anything.
I haven't got a word in as why. Like, all the gum beaters are just talking.
You know what I love? I love this one. To take a nap is to collar a nod. Isn't that great?
That's
I'm going to go collar a nod.
I don't get it.
What do you mean? I'm going to go collar a nod, grab a nod, nod
oh,
off.
Oh, nod. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I
don't
get it now.
Get it.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
You got to get outside more.
Yeah.
You got to hang with me and Cedric. Yes. We know what's going
you
on out there.
You guys know what's
oh,
up.
These new generations.
They don't know shit.
Collar a nod. You got to do it.
Jelly or jelly roll is sex. I knew that. Come on.
Come
I wasn't
on,
born
everybody.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
That's back Vogue.
Yeah. Bones or dice? Hey, I need some jelly roll tonight. I've been beating my gums all day.
Oh, wow.
And then I call it a nod, and now I'm ready for some jelly roll.
Okay, wait a minute.
Wait, this isn't good?
Yeah, that's crossed the line.
Across the line? I said I was beating my gum and beating my gum.
Oh,
and now I'm ready for some jelly roll. Okay, I think I did this wrong. Cedric, why did you give me these terms? Why did you write this book? You've ruined my life.
That made me laugh so hard. That's funny.
A stroker, I love this, is a player who makes overly complicated bets and causes dealers to work harder unnecessarily, usually pissing them off. That is so specific.
Yeah, that's like, you know, this is the guy that's like, yo, give me 4 on the hard 8, but take the 2 down, move that nickel to the 2, take this 2. I'm gonna take the yo on the come out, but I'm gonna move this to the pass line. And you're like, I've seen this too. Like
you have,
in
sure,
Vegas,
sure you
like,
yeah.
Yo, like, that's a lot, bro. Like, I don't even know what's going on right now. Like, you know, so.
And also, the poor dealer just burned more calories and wasted more time for this guy's nickel, you know, whatever. It's ridiculous.
And then he's gonna lose it all on one stroke and just curse everyone out after that.
Well, I think it's very cool that you've written this, and then it's a caper. It's a real story because main character, I don't want to give away too much, but he gets in some trouble and he needs to come up with a lot of money or he's in real trouble. And then that's where the fun begins.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that. You know, I was really inspired by the Walter Mosley books, those like Devil in a Blue Dress and, you know, that character right there, the Fearless Jones. He has a couple of characters that I love, that kind of writing, that, you know, that film, 40s film noir energy.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, it's just like a regular guy doing something and out of nowhere, he's in the middle of something super crazy. And that's what we did here. So, you know, he's got a regular life that he does that is, you know, in between the lines of good and bad, like being a good dude. And he makes a choice that puts him in deep. And now he has to kind of like, again, like he's always been a pretty much lucky as a gambler, he has to fight himself out of it. And so the caper just digs him in a hole, and it's so much fun. And we, you know, I just had a good time weaving the story.
Yeah. How long did it take you to do this?
It was over a year. It took a while, you know, because I had a great co-writer, who helped me kind of like take my ideas and then formulate this thing. So Alan Eisenstock, great dude. And we kind of like locked in with each other. And that's when it became, you know, it became just this fun idea. We just took our time and made sure we did exactly what we wanted to do. Like, I had it in my head. But, you know, of course, the formula of writing a novel, I'm not a novelist. So, you know, but I think of stories very vividly. So that's how. We took our time and killed it.
Rule number one is always write what you know. And you know Caruthersville, Missouri, and you know this 4th of July weekend, and you really know these people.
Yeah.
So that's that you knocked rule number one out of the park. You know, you didn't write a story about, it's Mars. The year is 3075.
No space. No space odyssey. I wouldn't
that's
know
the
what
next
to do
book.
With it. Yeah, same character, though.
Gambling on... Yeah. Same character. Welcome to Mars. Yeah, hi. You got any jelly roll around here?
You gum flapper, you.
You are making us uncomfortable with your crude references to sex. Well, the book is, the novel is Flipping Boxcars. And I have to say, I was just delighted that you could come in. You are such a funny guy, and always killing me, and just such a great
force. You are a force.
Yeah, man. Always, same thing, man. Always fun to be around you many years, you know, back in New York days. And then when you came out here, yeah. You know, just so just always fun to be around you, man. You're a fun dude. And, you know, like I say, I think that really works. So it's weird that you don't have a lot of friends, Conan. I mean,
it's really, yeah. Cedric, if you hung out a bit, you'd
yeah.
see.
Yeah.
I can hold it together for an hour.
Yeah, people
but no one in this room is questioning why I don't have a lot of friends.
Then it just get quiet.
It just gets real quiet.
Sit around
yeah.
like,
yeah.
Well, I'm going to go.
You know, it's a bad
in
sign.
In the middle of a podcast.
You know, it's a bad sign when people who work for me leave just start to walk away during the podcast. What happened, Conan? Where'd they all go?
Yeah, kind of ran out of gas there. Yeah, no, hey man, definitely.
All right,
an
and
honor
just work
and
me into a cameo on your show when the strike is over.
Fun,
I'll come back because you've dealt with, you know, white people, but you haven't dealt with a really white guy, like a guy who's
so
super white.
Yeah,
like so white that white people
like,
would
be like, what is going on?
Like, is he okay?
Yeah, like what's happening?
Yeah. Was it I actually went and
we're gonna have to move.
We were shooting in Haiti and all these kids gathered around me and they were touching my arms in Haiti. Yeah. And remember, and they were like looking at the freckles on my arms, and then one man was just staring at me and I said, "What are you looking at?" And he said, "I want to know if you are well." He thought I was sick. I'm like, I'm not sick. I guess I am.
Yeah, I
guess I'm kind of sick. Anyway, Cedric, thank you so much for stopping
awesome,
by.
Awesome, man. Thank you,
bring joy wherever you go. And I'm excited for your book.
Yeah, thank you, man. Pre-order it. Go and get it now.
Flipping
man.
Boxcars. Check
please.
It out.
Check it out, man. All right, definitely, brother.
It's been a while, but you remember we used to listen to voicemails from people that would call in and we'd answer their questions?
Yes, back in olden times.
Yeah, well, we don't have any today, and that's kind of what we're going to talk about.
Okay.
Our system for collecting voicemails has failed us.
What?
And now we have a brand new phone number.
Wait, I have a, first of all,
yeah.
How long has this been going on for and why wasn't I made aware?
It's been going on for a while.
What kind of shitty organization do we have here?
Oh, a shitty one.
Okay. Oh, there. Oh, of the shitty ones, this is the shittiest. I'm just curious. Have people been trying to leave messages and they couldn't?
I believe they either couldn't or we couldn't retrieve them because it had something to do with us leaving an old network that we used to belong to and, you know, company changing companies.
Is it possible that people have been leaving messages out there for us and we haven't been getting them?
It's possible.
That's terrible.
In fact, I'd say it's likely.
That's awful. I feel badly. What if people were really needing us or needing our help?
The number just got disconnected. People have not been leaving messages that we haven't retrieved.
Blay, you're killing the drama.
Oh, Blay, this is drama?
No, I'm going to shut up.
No, Blay, I'm glad.
Oh, no, cut this
was
part.
This supposed to
no,
be,
no, no,
this
don't
was
cut
supposed
it.
To be dramatic?
No, don't cut it. That's actually good information for me to have because okay. It would kill me if people were leaving us messages. I have a need to please. Blay, I'm glad you grabbed the mic in your Hawaiian shirt and told us.
I mean, it's got flowers on it. And not every flowered shirt is a Hawaiian shirt.
He's right.
Thank you.
No, sorry, Jerry Garcia. I didn't. maybe it isn't a Hawaiian shirt.
I don't mean to kill the
drama. I hope you can get the band back together. You guys were really grooving there for a while. I am glad. And stop telling us what we can cut and can't cut. We're going to leave this all in.
Okay.
People need to know what a stumble bum you are.
I'm sorry. Anyway, don't worry. No messages were left that you don't know about. It the number just
doesn't exist. It failed a long time ago and no one did anything about it.
Yes. I mean, there are messages that the listeners don't know about because I would say one out of every 50,000 is usable.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a terrible thing to say. Why?
Well, they're just sometimes raving lunacy on there. And I'm not even joking.
Well, wait a minute. Maybe my father's in trouble.
But maybe we should talk about some tips for the listener because we have a new phone number.
Oh, we've got a new number.
That if you want to get your voicemail on the podcast, here are some tips.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
We can talk about how...
We have tips?
Well, I could think of a few.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. First of all, should we read the number and then we'll read it again?
Yes, I'll read
the
number. Okay. If you want to contact us or if you're a raving lunatic that wants to scream into the void, call 669... 587-2847. That number again, 669-587-2847.
Okay. keep it concise, keep it friendly, keep it fun. Those are my tips.
You know what? I'm going to guess that anyone who was calling and leaving angry, insane messages, I think your tip's probably going to change their mind.
Oh, golly. I just heard it. He don't want me to call and yell into the phone anymore about the spaceman and the dragon in my ass. Best not call that number then. I'll try it again.
Hello. How are you? I'm an Aries. Curious what sign you guys are. Your little tips will do no good.
I thought we could also, because Sona's going to leave the outgoing message.
Oh, I am?
We can just do that right now, and listeners can hear it, and then we'll take that and we'll use it.
Yeah, let's use it. Sona, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hey, you called us, and this is, why are you giving me the phone number?
So you can say it.
But they called the number to get to the voicemail.
Right, you're just congratulating them that they got it right.
Hi, you called this number, and you heard a dial tone, not a dial, you heard the beep, and then you're leaving a message.
Keep it concise.
Keep it concise.
I'm friendly.
And friendly.
Say your name.
Say your name. Hey, you might hear your message on the podcast, and we will get back to you as soon as we can. No, we're not going to get back to them. Are we going to get back to them?
This is the worst outgoing message I've ever heard. This is, I think, the worst outgoing message in the history
of
the world.
When you tell me to do something like this, it gets me very nervous.
I forgot Sona's personal little quirk is that if you give her a task, she's terrible.
Thank you for calling.
All right. Well, listen, reach out to us. 669-587-2847. That number again, 669-587-2847. Leave us a concise message. We'll get back to you. Or we won't get back to you, but we might reach out to you through the podosphere.
Conan O'Brien needs a friend. With Conan O'Brien, Sona Movsesian, and Matt Gourley. Produced by me, Matt Gourley. Executive produced by Adam Sachs, Nick Liao, and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Theme song by The White Stripes. Incidental music by Jimmy Vivino. Take it away, Jimmy. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, and our associate talent producer is Jennifer Samples. Engineering by Eduardo Perez. Additional production support by Mars Melnick. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, and Britt Kahn. You can rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for Conan? Call the Team Coco hotline at 669-587-2847 and leave a message. It, too, could be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded.